Hi there, listeners. It's Farnoosh, and I just want to say I'm really honored that you've chosen to subscribe to So Money. I know there are a lot of podcasts out there. The fact that you're here is not lost on me. Now, if you're enjoying these episodes and you're benefiting from the advice and you want more, I've actually created something really special for us. It's called the So Money Members Club. It's an online platform where you can connect more closely with me and engage with fellow So Money fans who want to become more empowered in their financial lives. The website is SoMoneyMembers.com. And when you go there, you'll learn all the benefits, including exclusive monthly finance workshops, private group calls with me. You get your questions answered in our member community. I'm often in there weighing in, and you get instant access to all of our workshop recordings. We have a robust library that's growing. So far, we've had workshops on investing in real estate, kids and money, and how to earn more in 2024. And most of all, it's fun, positive, encouraging, all the things personal finance should be. Go to SoMoneyMembers.com, and I hope you'll join us. I'm limiting enrollment, and doors will close soon. Check out SoMoneyMembers.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. So Money episode 1522, Firuzeh Duma, author of the New York Times bestseller, Funny in Farsi.
You're listening to So Money with award-winning money guru, Farnoosh Torabi. Each day, get a 30-minute dose of financial inspiration from the world's top business minds, authors, influencers, and from Farnoosh herself. Looking for ways to save on gas or double your double coupons? Sorry, you're in the wrong place. Seeking profound ways to live a richer, happier life? Welcome to So Money.
It's called Surviving Fame Within the Iranian Community. That is a whole nother podcast. And by fame, I mean, I'm not that famous, but I mean, even just being known publicly a little bit. No, the haters are like coming out of the woodwork all the time. And I was shocked because when I wrote Funny in Farsi, I just thought, there's nothing in this book that anybody can possibly be offended by. But it turns out that my existence can be offending. This was news to me because people, I mean, I would get emails and they say, why are you wasting your time with stupid stories that aren't even funny? You should be talking about politics.
Welcome to So Money, everybody. Happy Monday. Today, I have the honor of welcoming a great luminary whose words have touched the hearts of millions. I first discovered Firuzeh Duma when I was a young 20-something, growing up, never quite feeling like it was quote-unquote cool to be Iranian. And, you know, I love my heritage, but it sometimes did create barriers for me when I was trying to make friends, feel connected to the American way. And then at 23 years old, I read Funny in Farsi, and this book became a smash hit. It is a compelling memoir, a heartwarming, humorous account of Firuzeh's Iranian family's journey from Iran to the United States. I found the book emotional. It beautifully explored the complexities of identity, and it's funny, as the title promises, which means it is also really powerful. It has stayed in my brain for 20 years. This is 20th anniversary since Firuzeh wrote this book. And today I have the honor of having her on the show. We are going to talk about her journey. We're going to unravel the layers of her journey. We're going to explore the joys and challenges of embracing a multicultural identity. So even if you're not Iranian or know about the Iranian experience, but you have felt othered as you were growing up and perhaps still, you have to listen to this show. Here's Firuzeh Duma. Firuzeh Duma, welcome to So Money.
Thank you.
20 years in the making. I first needed to get a podcast. Got that, check. Read your book, check, and have been a fan for 2 decades. You have no idea how influential you have been, and so often your words in my mind as I am, you know, putting one foot in front of the other as a grown adult woman in this country, an Iranian-American woman in this country. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your 20th anniversary of Funny in Farsi.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all your kind words. I'm very touched. Thank you.
It is not hyperbole. I'm not exaggerating here. Your book for so many, for millions of people, was a permission to be Iranian finally in this country and to be proud of that and to find the humor in that and to celebrate that. I was hearing you talk about sort of the genesis of this book. I want to get into a little bit of that even more. Like, you were 36 years old when you published it. You had never written professionally before, but what turned you to writing this, I was understanding that it was 9/11. So maybe we could start there a little bit with just sort of what was the fuel for this. You wanted to write your story for your children. It ended up being the story for so many people. But what was it about that time that drew you to this project?
So I started writing when I was 36 years old. I'd never, ever written creatively before. I mean, I'd written papers in college, but nothing creative. And I started writing simply because I wanted my kids. I had 2 kids at the time. I have 3 now, but I just wanted them to know my stories. I had grown up in America and I'd never, ever seen my story on TV or in a movie or in a book anywhere. And I just thought, if I want my kids to know what my life was like, I'm going to have to write these stories. So I joined a writer's group when I was 36 years old. And I wasn't planning on publishing my stories, but 9/11 is what changed my mind. And it was a friend who actually pointed out to me and said, you really should try to get these stories published. And it took me almost a year to find an agent because agents kept telling me humor and Iran don't go together. There's no audience for that. And I was told, you know, you can write about oppression. Oppression is in. Oppression is hot. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, first of all, I wasn't oppressed. I would say my dad ruined that literary career of mine, but by not oppressing me. But more importantly, I wanted to put my stories out in the world, which are about joy. That's what I wanted my legacy to be. I did not want to write another sad story for people to read. I wanted to write a story that would make people want to go next door and meet their Iranian neighbor.
As you write, it is through humor that we can soften some of the worst blows that life delivers. How do you, Firuzeh, incorporate the humor in your storytelling so that, you know, you're tackling 2 things. You're tackling what is serious, but what is also has levity. And to strike that balance is a work of genius. How do you approach that? Or is it natural? Because you're a funny person. I think you're a funny person. I just think I don't think you have to work at it. Like, you either have it or you don't. But to write that, right, to write it in word form is a different task.
So first of all, thank you for your kind words again. Writing is something I don't think about. It's one of the few things in life I do on automatic pilot. I don't know how I write. I don't know. I don't have a process. I just sit and write. And I write the same way that I talk. I'm the same person I am on stage as I am at Trader Joe's. And I'm the same person who write in the stories. People, when they meet me, they go, God, you're just like your work. And I go, yeah, I am truly a one-trick pony. So I can't give any advice other than the fact that I grew up with a father who is very, very funny. But my father, more than being funny, is very kind. And so I sort of grew up seeing the humor, the gentle humor in life. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, there's so many different kinds of humor, and I sort of put humor in quotes because there's a lot of things. Like, I think humor at the expense of somebody is not funny. And right. So everything I do is very PG or probably even G rated. But it's good though. I don't want to lose listeners because thinking, oh God, it's PG, but I don't use shock value. You know, I just, I point out the things, the universal things in life that that are always there for everyone to see. Mm-hmm. And I think because I grew up with a father who pointed these things out to me, I just, you know, it's like if you grow up with a dad who's a great basketball player, you end up knowing how to shoot hoops, which is something I don't know how to do. So I give the credit to my father.
Your family moved here in the early 70s, and I'm curious what drew them here. What was the immigrant impetus to come to America?
We came in 1972 just for a two-year assignment. My father was an engineer with the National Iranian Oil Company. So we came to Whittier, California for a two-year assignment, and then we went back after 2 years. So it was just a limited time here. We came here just long enough to like try every junk food multiple times and, you know, shop at Sears and then go back after 2 years.
And but then you came back.
2 years later, he got an assignment to come back to work on the same project. So we were here when the revolution happened, but accidentally. So we weren't one of these people who was like smart enough to like foresee what was coming and like move the assets abroad. Not that my dad had any assets, but even what we had, you know, we left. So we were here accidentally, and it was very fortuitous for us.
Sort of our story too. My father came here with my mother. He was finishing his PhD. The plan was to go back to Iran full time. They had me here, which was just sort of a, not coincidence, but it was just like, it wasn't planned. They had me here and the plan was to go back to Iran. The revolution happened and they were like, let's see if we can figure out a way to stay in the States. So much luck in that story. What's your relationship with luck in your life? Or have you thought about luck and its role, right? In every facet of your life.
Okay, so Farnoosh, this is literally an entirely other podcast because my entire life, my favorite word is serendipity. Mm-hmm. And my entire life is based, the best things in my life have been completely serendipitous. I always say I think I'm the luckiest person I know, even though I've had devastating things happen in my life, but everybody does. But I'm also a weirdly lucky person, very, very lucky. Like I know things are going to work out and they do in the long run. They do, not necessarily in my time frame or how I think they're going to work out, but they do. But the other part of it is, and I think this is a really big part of luck, is you have to also be there to be lucky for other people. Like you have to, I think if you put it out in the universe, it comes back. This is when we're getting to the woo-woo portion of this podcast.
Yeah, no, because let's dive a little bit into this because you're right. Because I think, at least for me, the luck that I have really benefited from is because someone gave me a chance. Someone called me back. It was the people. The luck was in, it was the circumstance almost always involved somebody taking a chance on me. And I think that this is a very Iranian, Iruni, I think, perspective on life too. One of our gifts, maybe my mother raised me with this faith, like to have faith. And what is faith really? It's like believing in luck.
I'm going to have to tell you two stories.
Okay, please.
So I used to travel a lot on the lecture circuit. Unfortunately, COVID stopped that portion of my career, which I'm hoping is going to start again soon. But so I used to travel a lot. And as you know, a lot of times, people in airports and airplanes are in bad moods. So I used to always say, I'm going to be the person in the good mood. And so I remember I travel light. And when sometimes there'd be people and there was no room like for their luggage in the overhead bin. And I would say, oh, you know what? There's a room under my seat, the seat in front of me. And the flight attendant would be like, do you know this person? I'm like, no, but I'm only 5'4" and there's room. And so every chance I ever got, like whenever I'd see a mother traveling with little kids, I'd always say, let me know if you want me to help you. You know, I'm a mom myself. Sometimes people thought that was creepy, but a lot of times they took me up on it. And the truth is, like, I just always tried to be the nicest person in the airplane. And I also travel with Trader Joe's chocolates, you know, the individually wrapped. And so I offer it to my seatmates. And so everyone's in a good mood around me because they've been offered chocolate. And even if they say no, it already puts them in a better mood. Okay, it's a little manipulative, but it's okay. So
I'll take the chocolate.
I have to say though, when I travel, I have the best travel luck. If there's one seat left that I need, I get it. I always make my connections no matter how late my flight is. My luggage does not get lost.
I can't knock on wood right now, but I so wish
knock
I could.
Knock on wood. Watch me die in a plane crash. But no, I do have... really good luck. And I think, as silly as it sounds, I think when you enter the airport and you're like, wah, 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 you know, you're bringing and you're in a bad mood, you're going to attract people that are equally in a bad mood, and you just spread that bad mood. And the opposite is true. If you try to actually be that one nice person on the flight or in the airplane, people react, like they pick up on that energy, and you would be surprised.
Well, Stanford study says that empathy is contagious.
Oh, 100%.
I think that's part of it. He's like, you know, you want to pay it forward because you're so grateful for what just happened to you.
Well, and you know, the great thing is, like, with my career the past 20 years, I've had this really incredible opportunity to do nice things for people just because they like my work as a writer. And I just like, when I hear someone's in the hospital and they're a fan of mine, I call them. I surprise people. I call them. It takes 10 minutes out of my day. And it really changes somebody else's mood. Yeah. And as you know, we Iranian women, like, the phone is our best friend. I mean, I can.
I just wrote about this today in my email. I said, you know, one of the things that I do is I call people on the phone. Remember the phone?
Yeah. Oh,
remember dialing before texting?
I love the phone. And then, and the other thing is, you know, like, I was on Facebook. So I got a message on Facebook a couple of weeks ago from a 10-year-old girl. And it was such an incredibly mature message. And I thought, I wonder if she wrote this or her mom. And I noticed she lives in El Salvador. And I thought, what time is it in El Salvador? So I called her. And so I had this whole conversation with this 10-year-old girl named Delora, who was like the most...
So sweet.
Like, precocious 10-year-old I have met.
You always remember this.
Well, and me too. Me too.
It's a core memory. Yeah. Yeah. And you will too.
So I think whatever you do in your life, whatever your job is, look for those opportunities to be surprisingly kind. And man, you will be a happier person for it. You end up actually getting the reward, not the person for whom you're doing something to. Mm-hmm. And then I have to tell you, I do have such weird, weird luck. I mean, coincidence, serendipity. I just want to share a somewhat quick story. I'm recently divorced, and my youngest at the time we're going through this was 15, and she's now 17. But it was an ugly, ugly divorce, and I felt so horrible that this child had just seen me sob for almost a year. So I wanted to do something really special, and there was a ballet she wanted to see in London, and you know, I'm not wealthy, but this is where, you know, I realized I needed to do this. Like, this was a splurge I needed to make because I wanted to go and see this ballet with my daughter in London. And I knew she'd never forget that. And I knew I'd never forget it. So we went to London for 3 nights. And one of the things I wanted to do when I was there was to take her to the Yayoi Kusama exhibit at the Tate Modern. And Kusama is an artist. She's a Japanese artist. She's 93 years old. She's the hottest artist in the world right now. And but she has a really incredible story. She was treated horribly her whole life as an artist. She's a Japanese woman. But I'm telling you, this woman triumphed. Anyways, I wanted to take my daughter to this exhibit. And Kusama makes these immersive rooms that you walk in, and they have mirrors and lights. So anyways, we go to London. We go to the Tate Modern. It turns out that exhibit is sold out for 7 months. And I was so devastated because I had my heart set on having this experience with my daughter, of having this bond with her. So I kept asking different employees. I'm like, is there anything I can do? Like, are there cancellations? Can I join the museum? Like, what can I do? And everyone said, no, there's nothing, nothing, nothing. So I was really heartbroken. And finally, after like an hour of trying, we left the museum, went out the wrong door. And we end up on the street in London. And all of a sudden, I see someone I know from my hometown. And it's one of my middle daughter's friends that she'd grown up with. And so it was like a mirage. And I said, I called her name and she called my name. And I said, what are you doing here? And she said, I'm just passing through London for a couple of days. So I said, well, let's take a picture together and send it to your mom. So we take a picture. I text it to her mom, who's never around. She's always traveling. I texted the mom and I said, look who I just ran into in London. That was it. Well, it turns out the mom had COVID. And so she was at home. So she responded to my text and she said, what are you doing in London? And now I have never learned the fine art of texting. I still text in like paragraphs with punctuation. So I'm explaining to her the whole thing and mention the Kusama exhibit. I can't get in. And so then we go to pack our bags because we're leaving the next morning. And before we did, I went to the concierge and I was like, hey, is there any way I can get into the Kusama room, if you know what I mean? And the guy's like, no, that's the hottest ticket in town. So I start packing my bags and my phone pings about 10 minutes later. And the mom that I'd sent the photo to, she said to me, I know someone who knows someone who knows someone. I just got you guys into the Kusama exhibit. Okay. My jaw stayed open for 10 minutes. I didn't even say anything to my daughter. For like 10 minutes, I just stood there. And then I said to her, I said, you're not going to believe this. We just got tickets to the Kusama exhibit. So the next morning before going to the airport, we went and saw the exhibit, and it was everything I had dreamt it was going to be. And when I was standing in that room with my daughter in the infinity room with all the mirrors and all the lights, I just thought, there is a God. There is something. Yeah. Like this was, I mean, I don't even.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
For the longest time, I dreaded buying bras. It was like shopping for jeans. Impossible. You want a bra that's sexy, you want a bra that's comfortable, you can't have both. Well, now you can, thanks to Third Love. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, the ick, the ugh, out of bra shopping. That's why they make solutions for every bra problem or brablem. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school. Get smoothing, you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made with premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with the code PODCAST15. The weather's getting warmer as I record. It's a nice 73 degrees on the East Coast. So, finally, time to say goodbye to jackets and sweaters and, fingers crossed, hello to shorts and tees. And I need to update my wardrobe for the long haul. And, you know, I don't want to spend a fortune. So luckily, I found Quince. I'm honest. I've got a lineup of timeless pieces from Quince that keep me looking effortlessly chic year after year. I'm talking premium European linen dresses, blouses and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless 14-karat gold jewelry, and tons more. Best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. I have t-shirts from Quince, pajamas from Quince. My very chic and fashionable sister-in-law, Hannah, her whole closet is Quince. And people often stop us and ask, where did you get this? Don't tell me the price. And then when I do, they're shopping on quince.com. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/somoney for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/somoney to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/somoney. And I think it also is telling me that the world is beautifully small in that way. Well, like, what is that story telling you other than just life is serendipitous?
Well, to quote my 98-year-old father, I grew up with a father who used to tell me that there's a world that we see with our eyes and there's a world that we don't see with our eyes. And they're both just as real.
Oh, wow.
And I can tell you, I turned 58 in 2 weeks. I 100% believe that. And I could literally write an entire book on coincidences and things that that are just unbelievable. And, you know, like just to give you a really recent example, I've been trying to buy a condo because like all divorced women, well, I shouldn't say all divorced women, like most divorced women, I need a place to live. And I want a place that's mine and I can't afford to live in the town that I'm currently in. So I was looking in other places and I keep getting outbid and it's been really hard, but I have this faith of like, there's a house with my name on it and I'll find it. And so, a couple of weeks ago, my realtor called and said, you know, there's this condo, it's not for sale yet, but I think you should make an offer, but the price was too high. And I couldn't, I mean, it was too scary for me to spend that much of my money because I'm a writer, you know, I'm not in high tech. I don't have stocks. Like, so for me, like what I have is what I have. So that night I dreamt, my mother passed away on Easter Sunday and I dreamt of her and she took me by the hand. We went somewhere together. I didn't remember all the details, but when I woke up, I had this incredible surge of courage. So I called the realtor and I said, I'm going to make an offer on this condo. And I did. And I got it.
Oh my gosh.
And it was literally because of a dream I had with my mom. So
that is so, so special. Well, going back to your childhood, your memories of your mother and your father, and this is a financial show, and you just talked about, you brought up real estate. I didn't. I mean, that is so Iranian. Like you had to bring up real estate. But Firza, what did you learn about money growing up? What were the conversations like?
Oh my God. Okay. So my dad gave me more bad advice about money than anybody could ever. The man was like a font of bad advice. And I remember when we moved from Whittier, California to Newport Beach, California, when I was in sixth grade, and we were renting a house and the owner was an older lady and she wanted to sell the house. And so she came to my father and she said, look, I don't want to be a landlady anymore. I'm too old for this. I want to sell you my house and I'm going to give it to you at a really low price. And my dad said, no. So then she came back and she said, look, I'm going to deduct a year's worth of rent. Okay. But I really want to offload this house. And my dad was like, huh, what do you think I am, a sucker? No. So I said to my dad as a 12-year-old, I said, Dad, why don't you want to buy this house? Because I thought it would be a good idea. And this is the nugget that my father shared with me. He said, Firuze, when you own a house and something goes wrong, you have to fix it yourself. When you rent, it's someone else's problem. And I thought, well, that's genius. That's genius. Mm-hmm. Why buy when you can rent? That's what I learned from my dad. So the irony, of course, is that he lived to completely regret that decision because that house then went up in value, like, I don't know, 1,000%.
Right, right.
And so it sort of became a story that he loved to tell of like, oh, the condo I didn't, you know, the house I didn't buy in Newport Beach. And and then my dad had this really terrible habit that I learned from him, which was when he had money, my father would very generously loan, and by loan, I mean in quotes, to family and friends. Huge mistake. You should not do that. You should make sure that you have enough for yourself first. And if you do loan money, you need to do what my friend Denise does, which you have people actually write a contract and they pay you interest and there's nothing wrong with it, but it just makes it so that it's clear, like there's no vagueness.
Right.
And that's the thing. Like, you know, we have these families and we love them so much and we would do anything for them, but sometimes it's not such a good idea, like loan, you know, people money that you love, because you have to be very clear on whether it's a loan or if you're going to want to get it back and the time frame and what happens. And so, and that can end a lot of relationships.
Oh yeah. It's why I usually say don't lend unless you're already convinced it's a gift.
Right.
It's not unless a loan, unless there's a contract with it. And even then there's a good chance.
Well, you know, it's interesting. My friend Denise made a lot of money in high tech. And so all of a sudden she was a wealthy woman and she has a big enough heart that she did want to help people, but she didn't want to become an ATM, which is very smart.
Yeah.
So she lends it with a contract. And I learned that from her. I don't have enough to lend anybody, but if I did, there would be a contract involved and it would benefit both sides.
Hmm. Well, so now going a little bit back to your book, Funny and Farsi, and I remember reading it, and the feeling I got was that, well, you talked about it. You assimilated a lot growing. You intentionally assimilated a lot as a child. It was kind of your survival mechanism, and I related to that. When did that change for you? This, you know, I feel like for all of us, there's an arc as immigrants. Like, we come here and we sort of, you know, we feel like we want to Americanize really quickly because that's the way that we're going to be accepted. We have a fear of rejection. And then something maybe shifts in your life where you're like, oh, wait a minute, being Iranian is super duper cool, not just within the Iranian community, but even outside right. the Iranian community. When was that recognition for you? And where would you say you are now in kind of like living in these two, like you say you're very fully Iranian and fully American, but have you maybe shifted to one side or the other as you have gotten older?
Oh yeah, I definitely, well, I pick and choose the parts that work to my benefit. So, so as a divorced woman, I'm not going by anything I learned in my Iranian culture because none of that is good. I go by, you know, what I learn in the Western culture, which is, you know, you go girl. That's it.
Yeah. That's it. Power.
Yeah. That, you know, the second half of life is where all the gifts are. Mm-hmm. And that it's true. It if you believe it, it actually is true. So when I came to America in 1972, there were no Iranians anywhere near us. We ran into an Iranian one time in the 2 years that we lived in America. And we were, of course, at a mall. Because, like, where do you see Iranians? At the mall. It's like animals are in the zoo, Iranians are in the mall. So we ran into these Iranians, and we actually heard people speaking Persian, and we went up to them and we said, "Shuma Irani hasti? Like, are you Iranian?" I mean, it was like two polar bears running into each other in Hawaii. It was just shock. And it turned out they were actually just traveling through California. They didn't live here, but we nonetheless invited them to our house for a meal. And I remember telling my mom, like, "We need to get Kentucky Fried Chicken." Because I'm thinking, you know, they're, and my mother was like, nah. She made them, of course, a Persian feast. And so for me, assimilating wasn't even an option. Not assimilating was not an option. There were no Iranians anywhere. And then once you know, the revolution happened and Iranians did start coming to America, by then I was so fully, you know, assimilated that Iranians seemed foreign to me. These Iranians that were coming seemed foreign to me.
Yeah.
And then when I went to college, I attended college at UC Berkeley. That's when I thought, you know, I'm definitely going to start figuring out what parts of my Iranianness I really, really like and I want to keep, because it just wasn't even an option before. The survival mechanism was to fully assimilate. Mm-hmm. And now there's a lot I love about the Iranian culture. I mean, I love the warmth.
Tell me what you love most.
Oh, what I love, I think the warmth. You know, I lived in Germany for 6 years, and I remember thinking, wow, I love Germany for many reasons as well. But I kept thinking, this is like the opposite of Iran, you know, Germany and Iran, like polar opposites when it comes to how warm strangers are to one another. Yeah. And I love the hospitality. And I love the fact that, you know, Iranians are very fuzul, okay, which is nosy.
But
there's a positive side to that too, because, like, we want to know your story. Yes, it's for gossip reasons, okay? But we still want to know your story, and I like that. I like that people ask questions.
Well, I mean, that's why I'm a journalist, okay? Perhaps
it's basically
very fuzul, very fuzul
with a salary. So you go, girl. You go, girl.
I have made a career out of my fuzuli.
You go.
Yeah. I mean, we should just leverage our strengths. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And you know, for me, like being a storyteller, talking about myself endlessly, because all my stories are about myself, it is an extension of like the Mehmuni, where we're just endlessly talking. I just get mine published in the New York Times or in books. That's the only difference. But basically my conversation, what you're reading is what I was saying in some Mehmuni somewhere. So if you invite me to Mehmuni, you're saving yourself time and money.
One thing I wanted to ask you, and I think you may have discussed this on another podcast with Leila Shams, who's a brilliant creator of Chai in Conversation. And I think the two of you were talking about sort of this almost like, I don't know if it's like tension or like, okay, so I'll give you an example. And I think because I think this is universal within religions and cultures, there is like a lot of judgment going on. Like I had a professor in grad school who wrote a book called Jew versus Jew. And it was this sort of look at Jewish people, people of the Jewish faith, but all of the ways that they might be polarized within the community. And within the Iranian community, I felt growing up and still, especially now with so much happening politically overseas in Iran and the revolution, for me at least, I've gotten emails from like random people that are like, you're not being Iruni enough. You're not being loud enough as an Iranian. You should have Iranian in the first sentence of your bio. And it's like, they're judging me because I'm not as Iranian as they wish I was out loud. And that always, I mean, it hurt when I would, I get these emails. I'm like, oh, am I not being, I don't know, am I being disrespectful? Like, I'm sorry. But I feel like it's for them, it's like displaced anger. Have you ever experienced this? I'm sure you have, as you have had this globally celebrated book, but also probably some people who are like, I don't know, that were sort of the haters.
Okay. Like this is a whole nother podcast. Okay.
Yeah. We've had like four podcasts in one. I
mean, it is. It really is. It's called Surviving Fame Within the Iranian Community. That is a whole nother podcast. And by fame, I mean, I'm not that famous, but I mean, even just being known publicly a little bit. Mm-hmm. No, the haters are like coming out of the woodwork all the time. And I was shocked because when I wrote Funny and Farsi, I just thought there's nothing in this book that anybody can possibly be offended by. But it turns out that my existence can be offending. This was news to me because people, I mean, I would get emails and they say, why are you wasting your time with stupid stories that aren't even funny? You should be talking about politics. Why are you not writing about human rights? Why are you? And I'm like, why don't you write about human rights? Why don't you talk about politics? And you know what it is? I'm going to just be really mean for a moment, but I think these trolls deserve it. These are people who have done nothing with their lives. And how easy is it to sit behind your computer screen and just criticize those who have the courage to put themselves and their work out there?
Yeah.
So to all the haters out there, just go get a hobby and do something and contribute.
Yeah.
And then you will no longer actually feel the way you're feeling. Like you will actually be like you're a part of the conversation. Because I think part of it is this jealousy that they're not part of the conversation.
It's like that Instagram post I got in my feed because the algorithm knows me so well. It was like, regarding haters, like these aren't people that are on the field playing. They're the ones who bought the tickets to watch you play. And they think that you're some sort of spectator sport for them. I'm sorry, but no, I'm feeding a family. I'm making an impact. I'm putting myself out there. I'm failing forward. You know what? And you bought a ticket. You bought a front row to this. That says something. You know, I must be doing something right.
I mean, I used to be really, really devastated from the criticism because I just, you know, this, first of all, I'm a pioneer in criticism as an Iranian. This is 20 years ago when this book came out.
Right. Like,
I was totally unprepared. Like, nowadays, people talk about this. They talk about trolls. There's a word for it. But like, well, I was getting because my email used to be public. I was just getting emails from people and I was like shocked. Like I would just want to go lie down for the whole day. It was so upsetting to me. And so, but now, I mean, you do sort of, you just kind of say, God bless you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, as we wrap, Firuze, my gosh, this, I had all these questions. I think I got to like three of them, but that's always a sign of a great conversation when you have not even looked at your prep notes. But as you are now in your next chapter in your life as a go girl, independent woman, how do you want your luck to show up for you in these coming years?
Well, my luck does. It does keep showing up. There's something great around the corner on a regular basis. What I try to do is to contribute to that same river of good karma. So I'm not just taking from it, but also contributing from it. So I look for opportunities to contribute.
Well, I'll be watching in the front row, cheering you on. And I will pay lots of money for that ticket. Thank you so much for coming on So Money. Truly, this is for me, like I can already say I've been doing this podcast for 9 years. I am so glad we finally made this happen. Better late than never. And I so appreciate you and your work. And you're just as incredible in person as I thought you would be. Thank you for not letting me down in that way. Cause that, you know, that can happen sometimes. You put all your like hopes and dreams in meeting someone who's like your hero from afar and then they really disappoint you. But thank you, Firuze.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Firuzeh for joining us. I'll see you back here on Wednesday. In the meantime, if you want to pick up a copy of A Healthy State of Panic, pre-order it. You will get access to my program called Scared Smart. It's a 3-video series, plus the workbook, plus the introduction to A Healthy State of Panic to help you get a head start on some of the advice in the book on how to better relate to your financial fears and actually use your financial fears to make great money decisions. Go to healthystateofpanic.com for all of that. I hope your day is so money. Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.